We know so much about the American Civil War. In addition to all the books, there are movies, documentaries, probably even a few coloring books out there somewhere. Today's guest, though, shifts the focus on the Civil War to a point outside of our country, because the rest of the world took great interest in our Civil War. Don Doyle's book is The Cause of All Nations, an international history of the American Civil War. Don H. Doyle is a professor of history at the University of South Carolina. He's the author of several previous books, including Nations Divided, comparing the splits in our country and in Italy, where he saw Confederate battle flags on display. Don Doyle, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Well, thank you for having me, Jeffrey. I'm glad to be with you.
I'm going to guess that the battle flags in Italy was the first clue that our Civil War had foreign observers.
Yes, that was interesting. And, of course, for them it was in southern Italy, and it was often used as a kind of a protest against the domination of the north. And so there was I found a strange affinity between the south of Italy and the south of the United States.
Interesting that it continues today. And I understand you grew up in California, but you now certainly live in the South. Still very, very different views of the war, depending on where in the country you live.
Yes, it is. I became fascinated with the Civil War when I was a young man in California. My mother one day brought home a shoebox full of letters from my great-great-grandfather, whom she knew, and who had died, of course, long before I was born, but who, as a young drummer boy, had gone off to war. So I had a fascination with it. And it was later, as a professor teaching American history in Italy, in fact, as a Fulbright professor, that I began to look at America from outside and began to try to view America as foreigners saw it in the 1860s.
Which it may be a little hard for us to wrap our minds around. This was not a country that was as well established, certainly then, as it is now. Still something of a cult, I guess, in terms of its growth. And you say the Civil War was the first example of what came to be called public diplomacy. What do you mean by that?
Well, we usually think of diplomacy as being the negotiations between governments and the establishment of foreign policy. And so it's a kind of government-to-government negotiation, and it was very important to the American Civil War because the South wanted nothing more than to gain recognition as an independent sovereign nation. And the North, of course, was threatening war against any foreign power that did anything to aid what it considered a treasonous rebellion within one nation. So I argue that during the Civil War, both sides really invented what today we call public diplomacy, and it was the outreach to the public, the effort to try to enlist the public. Now, most of us will think, if we talk about that, of the word propaganda, and that I think of as more kind of a government agent, a diplomat perhaps, or some agent that they hire with a megaphone, kind of shouting at people, saying, this is what we're fighting for, believe us. And propaganda also inferring lies and misinformation. But public diplomacy was more, in the Civil War, more involved with enlisting native authors and trying to align one's values, one's ideals, one's objectives in the war with the basic interests of the public, and indirectly to bring public pressure to bear on foreign policy of particularly France and Britain, who were the two major maritime powers, and both of whom had threatened to intervene in the American Civil War. So that's the stage on which most of my characters are operating, is this war of ink and ideas, I say, that is taking place abroad at the same time that the war of bullets and bayonets is taking place back on the battlefields of America.
So something parallel to the actual hot war, but as you point out, not propaganda, more like public relations, it sounds like, more like image advertising, as we call it today.
Yes, but it also represents something that, again, in modern parlance, we call soft power, and that is not just telling people, here's our idea, here's what we're fighting for, and trying to sell it so much as enlisting native authors. And this is what the union was successful in, was getting intellectuals, journalists, to write, to loan their pen, sometimes for a price, sometimes voluntarily, because these native authors often saw the cause of the union as their own cause, so that French Republicans, for example, saw America as an example of self-government without kings, without aristocrats, and they wanted the union to survive, but also they were using the debate over the American question, as they called it, to open up debate within France. And similarly, in Britain, the advocates of expanded voting rights, John Bright and some of the others, saw the American question as a way of forcing this issue. And so it became, America, in their view, was kind of a proxy war, a battle, an epic battle in a long historic struggle that they had been fighting in Europe over the basic right of people to govern themselves.
Interesting. So where we talk about proxy wars today, where you get superpowers getting involved in a fight in some small country, we were that small country back then.
Yes, and a small country, but one in which it seemed that the democratic experiment, or sometimes they call it the Republican experiment, was really hanging in the balance, because all over Europe, the idea that people could govern themselves without a king, without an aristocrat, without a dynastic aristocracy, had really been defeated. Switzerland was the only republic of any size. Britain was a free society with a strong parliamentary tradition, but very few people there could vote, maybe one out of five adult males. So most people, and even many liberals in Europe, believed that democracy actually threatened liberty, personal freedom, and they believed more in constitutional monarchy.
Wow. So, a lot more to explore here. We're going to talk more with Don Doyle about his book, The Cause of All Nations, about the Civil War. It's an international history of the American Civil War. Back on The Exchange with Don Doyle and your phone calls and emails in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the history professor Don Doyle from the University of South Carolina. He's written a new book about the American Civil War, taking an international perspective, looking at the parts of the world outside of ours that took an interest and tried to influence our Civil War. The book is called The Cause of All Nations, An International History of the American Civil War. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this period in history and the fascinating foreign entanglements therein. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let me pick up that last point again, Don, because you were saying even places that valued liberty and freedom across the world had some suspicions that our system would be the undoing of that?
There was an idea that democratic societies or republics that did not have kings and aristocracies that elected their leaders would inevitably fall into either anarchy or despotism. And there was an idea that ever since ancient Rome that the Republican experiment had failed. And then more recently, of course, the French Revolution. And so it was conservatives, but also many, many moderate liberals that just believed that democracy, these experiments and self-rule actually endangered freedom. And so America was beheld by Republicans in Europe and also in Latin America, which they were even more fragile republics than ours, of course. And they looked upon the United States as, they called it, the Great Republic. And it was not perfect. It was had many flaws, they all realized. But it was the best working model of how a free people could govern themselves in peace and prosperity. And now, in 1861, it seemed like it was falling apart. And so I say in the book that when Lincoln said that America was the last best hope of earth, this is at the end of 1861, in his annual message to Congress. He wasn't bragging. America was really on the ropes, and so was the entire Republican experiment.
We have a couple calls waiting for you. Let's go first to Mike in Eagle Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Don Doyle.
Good morning. Years ago, I read a report that during the Civil War, the federal government, that is, the North, had retained the Russian Imperial Fleet to maintain a presence off our Pacific coast to help put down any insurrection that might rise up in California. And I cannot cite either the publication or the author, but he did go on to speculate that after the war, the North did not want to admit that we had to repay this debt to the Russian government, did not want to admit it, particularly to the defeated South, and so that some $5.5 million was disguised in the purchase price of Alaska. So I would be interested to know if your guest has any comment on that or any knowledge of that particular episode. Thank you.
All right, fascinating point. Thanks for that, Mike.
I don't have any particular knowledge of that controversy, but Russia was actually one of our friends in Europe at the time. They had just gone through the Crimean War against Britain and France, and there was no love lost between those countries. So when France and Britain tried to get Russia to come in with them in a multilateral plan for intervention or mediation, they called it, in the American Civil War, Russia stood back. And then later, it was in September of 1863, Russia sent its fleets, one to New York City and the other to San Francisco. And it was one of those excursions that formally or officially had no purpose, but it was widely interpreted as a show of friendship for the Union, and at a time when France and Britain were still menacing the United States with these plans to intervene. Now, at the end of the war, remember, we haven't talked yet about the plans of France to come into Mexico. And, of course, they installed Maximilian there. And part of that plan was not just to take over Mexico, but to reclaim all of the territory that had been given to the United States by Mexico. And so all of California might have become part of this French-dominated, what they called a Latin Catholic empire that would have stretched from California, perhaps Oregon, that they might have taken in the bargain. I'm not sure about that. But would have extended down into South America. And so it was a very deep game that the French were playing. And, yes, the Russians had an interest in that and that they were still ensconced in Alaska. But at the end of the Civil War, what you see is the retreat of empires. Spain pulls out of Santo Domingo and faces a revolution in Cuba. France pulls out of Mexico, and, of course, Maximilian is left to face a firing squad. Russia sells Alaska. It was an amiable and peaceful sale under with no duress or coercion. But still, I think they realized, they sized it up and saw America with a very powerful army and navy, and they also had a plan there to hem in and possibly divide Britain, which was consolidating its territory north of the United States in what became known as Canada. So there was even in the late 1860s, the Americas were still surrounded by these European imperial forces all around the United States. And the Union's victory really changed the map in so many ways.
Really established us as a stronger country, ultimately.
Yes. Strong militarily, and also it had proven, even after 4 years of war and a terrible assassination at the end, that democratic society, instead of being inherently fragile, was actually extraordinarily strong. And it was really a lesson to the monarchs of Europe that these republics were a lot tougher than they realized.
Huh. Another call here from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Don Doyle, the author of The Cause of All Nations.
Professor Doyle, I agree with your last conclusion in particular. Now, I remember, as I recall, the Russian Pacific Fleet was in pretty poor repair, and a lot of it sank at the docks in San Francisco, but that's a minor detail. But it was the gesture that counted there, yes. In any event, my question deals with the run-up to the American Civil War. Was there a lot of, or did you find evidence of European meddling in the cause of the North and the cause of the South that, that helped exacerbate the situation that, that led to the Civil War? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thanks, Paul.
That's a good question. One of the puzzling things in that my book raises is that the South kind of jumps off the cliff with this idea that Europe is going to recognize them, that they are going to want to come in to get cotton, and that the Confederacy will simply proclaim its existence. They don't really have a Declaration of Independence, but they set up a government and send over envoys. Just before the Civil War, there were a lot of kind of secret negotiations with agents being sent over by South Carolina, Louisiana, Mississippi, negotiating with the European powers. And there were fascinating rumors that what the Southerners were doing was inviting, for example, the French to come back into Louisiana and to set up a kind of quasi-colonial relationship with the South. There was a letter that I discovered signed by, it appears, Judah P. Benjamin, though he disclaimed it, but it was sent to a British diplomat in New York and suggesting that the South wanted nothing more than to leave the Union and to escape all of this extreme democracy, as they called it, and to rejoin the British Empire. And so those rumors really spread around, and I of course, they couldn't be discussed openly because the South obviously had a war to fight, and whatever one says about slavery and the kind of aristocratic pretenses of the planter class, it was a democratic society formally and in spirit. And so it was a rumor that later came back to cause a lot of problems for the South, especially at the beginning of the war when they became more public, these rumors.
Don H. Doyle is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of history at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. His book is The Cause of All Nations, an international history of the American Civil War, a look at what the rest of the world thought about what was going on within our borders at that time in history. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments at 800-838-3760, out and about the listening area, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So the whole view from the South that King Cotton was really going to be an important factor in getting other countries to join us in this, and yet at the outset of the war, there was very little discussion of slavery, apparently. And you make it clear in the book that, that both South and North said, no, this is not what we're fighting about.
Well, all through the 1850s, they fought about slavery and its expansion. It was mainly the argument over the containment of slavery, so that the Republican Party, some of them were true abolitionists and even racial egalitarians, but the mainstream of the Republican Party were what we call free soil, anti-slavery Republicans. They wanted to contain it, and eventually, after containing it, forcing it to kind of wither away, and perhaps through colonization of blacks and or of former slaves and that kind of thing. But it was slavery was very much on the minds of politicians on both sides, and of course the Southern secessionists. But once the secession crisis erupts, Lincoln is trying to assure the South that he is not an abolitionist, that the Constitution does not permit him to interfere with slavery in the states, and that the only thing the Republicans want is to prohibit any further states from entering as slave states. And the South, of course, is all too happy to put slavery aside and not to defend that. And so you begin with this kind of curious situation in which the Southern slaveholders are making a liberal argument that we are a people, we want to govern ourselves, we are asking for the same thing that our forefathers asked for in 1776. And it's the North that adopts a kind of conservative and imperial, if you will, argument that we are one nation, these are treasonous rebels, and they have no cause for rebellion. So that changes, of course, but that's the beginning. And that's part of the reason, a big part of the reason, why Europeans and others all around the world were so puzzled as to what side, what was the purpose of the war, and what side should they align with.
Huh, because each side was kind of moving away from what really ended up ultimately the major focus of the war. The period in history we haven't even talked about yet, but you point out in the book that this is 1861, the beginning of our Civil War, just 13 years after a round of revolutions or would-be revolutions in Europe in 1848. So did, for example, Southern leaders take inspiration from the likes of Giuseppe Garibaldi, who was trying to unite Italy?
Yes, they were initially trying to align themselves with these liberal causes in Europe. And, for example, Garibaldi and the Italian Risorgimento was really very much approved of in Britain. The broad British classes, including the aristocrats, really helped sponsor the Italian Risorgimento and approved of it and adored Garibaldi. Though they began to see him more as a kind of dangerous revolutionary as the 1860s went on. But this was something that, of course, the South was trying to position itself as a nationalist, but at the same time they didn't want to go too far with that liberal rhetoric. They didn't want to be seen as what Europeans called red Republicans. They argued that they were engaged in a peaceful secession. The word was loaded with meaning, and they were not revolutionaries overthrowing the structure of government, simply separating from it. And a lot of their rhetoric went in the other direction, and that was to say that we are like the European aristocracy and that we are people, we are a society ruled by the best rather than by the, you know, the dregs of Europe who elected Abraham Lincoln, this unknown prairie lawyer who's been heaved up into the very height of power in the North.
Back to Giuseppe Garibaldi himself, was he actually offered to come over and be part of this fight?
Yeah, that's the story that got me interested in this whole book-length project. When I was in Italy, I learned that the Lincoln administration had sent agents over to negotiate with Giuseppe Garibaldi, who at that time, since 1860, he had led this campaign to unify the South in Italy. He was a world hero. I mean, everyone knew what he looked like, who he was. Women wore the Garibaldi fashion. He was a real rock star celebrity. And when he let it be known through one of his lieutenants that he might be interested in raising his sword, as they said, for the Union, Lincoln and Seward sent Henry Sanford to this little island in the middle of the Mediterranean to meet with Garibaldi. And that was when Garibaldi said, "Is this about the emancipation of the Negroes or not? And if it's not for universal emancipation, then it will be just like any civil war, over territory and sovereignty, and of no real interest to the world." So the negotiations fell apart, but Garibaldi comes back on the stage a year later in September, October 1862, and really plays a very important role in upsetting the plans of Britain and France to intervene on behalf of the South. And he gives at that time a full-throated endorsement of the Union cause, which is now the cause of liberty and emancipation.
So obviously there was a pivot at some point from Lincoln and his administration to explain, okay, the war effort we said was about this. Now it really is about emancipation and ending slavery.
Yes. And we've always understood that turn that Lincoln makes as one of, usually we ascribe it to Lincoln's kind of slow, reluctant moral awakening, but it's much shrewder than that. And it's not just about domestic politics. He was, of course, concerned about the border states and losing Kentucky and Maryland, which were slave states but still in the Union. But emancipation was also foreign policy, and Lincoln understood that. And I make a great deal out of a meeting that he and a German immigrant by the name of Karl Schurz have early in 1862. And that's what really enlightened Lincoln about the importance of emancipation for foreign policy.
All right. I want to find out more about what Karl Schurz said that got Lincoln so influenced. We'll come back and talk more about that. The book is The Cause of All Nations, An International History of the American Civil War by Professor Don Doyle. We'll come back and talk more with Don and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're heard on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, and we're talking to Professor Don H. Doyle about his book, The Cause of All Nations, An International History of the American Civil War. Lots of players outside the borders of the United States, or the CSA as well, if you prefer, who were taking an interest in what was going to come out of the conflict here in America. Join us on the exchange with questions or comments at 800-838-3760. 800-838-3760. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. So Karl Schurz, this American, rather German diplomat, talking to Lincoln. What was that conversation about? How did it take place?
Schurz had been appointed to Spain. Here was this radical 1848 revolutionary from Germany who had been a big champion of the Republican Party in the Midwest, now appointed to this very conservative Catholic monarch government of Queen Isabella II. And he was very restless. He wrote to Seward in September of 1861, early in the war, and said that he felt very frustrated with the diplomatic mission in Spain, and he realized that the governments of Europe were conservative, anti-democratic, and they wanted the very worst for the United States. They wanted it to fail, and they wanted it to fragment, and they wanted it to fail partly because they wanted to see democracy fail. But the European public, or at least the liberal elements of the public, workers and the broad middle class, Schurz argued, wanted to side with the Union if only the Union would make this a war with some moral purpose, to raise the war, he said to Lincoln, to a higher moral plane, and to make it about slavery, emancipation, of course, and the preservation of republican institutions. And Lincoln has this talk with him. Schurz resigns, he comes back and hurries down to Washington, and they meet at the White House, and Lincoln listens to him. And it was a marvelous conversation at a moment where Schurz realized that Lincoln had read his dispatches. Lincoln understood. Here was this very unworldly man, self-educated, had never been outside the United States, didn't read any foreign languages, and didn't read foreign newspapers. But he had this understanding, this political understanding, and an idea that Europeans, at least the popular classes in Europe, wanted what America had, that is a self-governing society. And he told Schurz, I understand, and I realize that no foreign power would dare intervene in a war once it became a war for or against slavery. But our we're not ready for that. Europe might be, but we're not. And help me, he told him, by criticizing this stance that I have taken. Insurers came out of the office realizing that that Lincoln, instead of feeling defensive in the face of criticism, actually was inviting it and encouraging the left wing of the Republican Party to move him, the administration, and the public toward the Emancipation Edict that he later that year would issue.
Which buttresses another claim you make in the book, a point to really pay some attention to, which is that the wars of independence, of any kind of war, I suppose, are not all about battlefields. They're about the points you're trying to make and the kind of society in which you want to live. And it sounds like Lincoln was forced to up the game just a bit here. And it became less of like, never mind foreign countries, we'll deal with this on our own terms. But it became like a more elevated struggle. And it sounds like in a symbiotic way, it inspired him back.
Yes, I think so. Lincoln listened. He listened to Shores, and he listened to others, and I think that he began to understand that that he would have to change the game. And he uses just that kind of expression. For one thing, the military battle was not going well. The struggle to overtake the Confederacy in the Peninsular Campaign that summer of 1862 was failing. And it was failing in part because of poor leadership under McClellan, but also because it was just the Confederates were dug in. They were fighting very vigorously, and Lincoln just didn't have the right leadership. He had an army, but not good generals. But often separatist movements like this, they're decided not by military victory, but by just the separatists outlasting the parent nation. And, we've seen a lot of kind of pipsqueak revolutionaries win against great odds, and none was more exemplary of this than the United States after 1778, when the French came in and helped us beat the British. But we beat the largest military power there, not by defeating them militarily all the time, but just wearing them down, exhausting their treasury, bleeding the enemy. And that's what the South was doing to the United States. So there was a political problem as well as a military problem that Lincoln faced at home. And he had to up the game, but he also was aware that the European powers were just about to intervene, and they had to act quickly. And so he played his last card. He said, we were at the end of our rope. And so emancipation was a inspired by a strong ideological antipathy towards slavery, but also by a lot of practical, pragmatic politics, and Lincoln was a master of that.
Now, much attention focuses on England, but England actually took an official position fairly early in the war, didn't it?
Yes, it was neutral officially. Unofficially, they were allowing the arms manufacturers to sell to the Confederacy and to the United States, but to the rebels in the South, and also to build warships, to build the Alabama and the Florida and other raiders, Confederate raiders, that did a lot of damage on the high seas to the Union merchant marine. So a lot of people thought that they were tilting in favor of the South. And, of course, France, which did not have a powerful navy, but it did have one, they had a lot more skin in the game. I mean, Napoleon III now had invaded Mexico, had 30 or 40,000 troops in Mexico defending Maximilian. He really needed for the Confederacy to win in order to create a buffer state between the United States and Mexico. So there's a lot of geopolitical gamesmanship going on here on a very big stage in the 1860s.
Let's take another call. We have Ron and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Don Doyle, the author of The Cause of All Nations.
Hi, thanks for letting me in.
Sure.
Professor Doyle, the question that runs through my mind after particularly listening to you, and also having read many other books on the Civil War, is why do you think that the story we get in high school about the Civil War is so quite different than what certainly seems to be the reality?
In the sense of what? That it was about slavery?
In the sense that, you know, Lincoln, this, what you get in high school is that, you know, that Lincoln was running this campaign to free the slaves, and that it was an internal civil war. You don't hear anything about any sort of external, you know, interests that were involved. You don't hear that Lincoln had, you know, to change his mind about this whole idea of slavery. That's not where he started out, that where he ended up, almost came out of a default position in order to be able to save the Union. I guess in a way what you hear in high school is, you know, Lincoln was one of the greatest presidents we ever had, and perhaps he very well may have been, but it seems like it's all built around this ideal that he had to abolish slavery, and everything I've read after that time suggests that wasn't the case, that, you know, that's not the way it really came down, but it came down like the professor is talking about.
Okay, let's explore this. Thanks for the call, Ron. Appreciate it. So why do you suppose there's a disparity there in the accounts?
Well, the Civil Wars are really, really difficult histories. The time was they used to have a Southern edition of high school textbooks, and they would call it the War Between the States. And the histories were kind of parallel, but they were taught differently and with different nomenclature in the South. So it even now, I mean, since the 1960s, earlier there was an idea that, well, the whole war was a mistake. It was just a bunch of fanatics on either side and blundering politicians that couldn't compromise. And it was kind of a tragic brothers war over silly issues that should have been resolved. Slavery was going to disappear, and that kind of revisionist view. And then in the 1960s, historians began to focus more on slavery and race, and they were writing the history of the 1860s in the light of the 1960s and began to see the Civil War as the first painful step toward America's reckoning with race, the legacy of slavery. And I think there was, at least among the scholars of the American Civil War, a very profound understanding of Lincoln's, not his moral flaws, I won't say that, but just his, all of the political circumstances that surrounded emancipation and that surrounded his views on race. And so I think most realistic historians don't see, you know, Father Abraham as a morally perfect man from his youth, but we do know that he was deeply, profoundly, morally opposed to the institution of slavery, always and consistently. But how he dealt with that changed and evolved over time, and that comes out of kind of the pragmatic politician, but also it comes out of a man who at first had deep doubts about the idea of, for example, arming slaves. I think he said at one point, if we arm the slaves, then the enemy will wind up with the guns. They won't fight. And there was a kind of common racial assumption that blacks wouldn't fight. And when they did, and when they proved themselves in battle, Lincoln was impressed, and he really began to change his mind. And he scolded whites who said that they didn't want to fight for the emancipation of blacks. He said that they are willing to fight for your freedom, but you're not willing to fight for theirs. And so he evolved. I mean, I think we all evolved on these big issues, and it comes out of not just pragmatic politics, but also out of listening. And that was what Lincoln did a lot of on foreign policy as well as on domestic and emancipation policy.
Without actual foreign recognition, the Confederate States of America didn't have any actual ambassadors, but they did send people to foreign capitals. And were they generally just agitating for intervention, for support behind the scenes, some combination?
Officially, they did not ask for intervention or military aid, but of course, had any of the countries recognized the Confederacy, they soon would have been pulled into the war because that's what Seward, William Seward, the Secretary of State, promised. He said, we will wrap the world in flames if any nation dares to aid this rebellion.
Did any country come close to recognizing the CSA?
Well, yes. In 1862, in September, Britain, the Palmerston administration in Britain, was laying plans for this multilateral intervention. And Napoleon III was eager to go forward. And the plan was that they would offer mediation. And under international law, if third parties that are being affected by a prolonged war offer mediation, and if one party refuses, as they knew the North would, then they have a legitimate right to recognize the other party. And that is exactly what the British wanted to do. And then everything came a cropper, and it was because of, I argue it was because of Garibaldi, at least this was one thing that upset the apple cart. He caused a crisis with a march on Rome. He was wounded. He was imprisoned. They thought he was going to be sentenced to die. And there were demonstrations all over Europe and huge, massive, they called them riots, but they were public demonstrations and big fights, too, in Hyde Park. And the French cabinet had a crisis, and Napoleon had to tend to that. And the British government got cold feet. They did not want to go into a war facing America alone. This would have been the third war, and the other two did not go well for Great Britain.
That is very true. It's a really fascinating book with a lot of details in places far from places like Bull Run and Antietam. The book is called The Cause of All Nations, An International History of the American Civil War. Don H. Doyle wrote it. He's been our guest. Don, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I really enjoyed it.